So Lent for 2019, what are we going to be doing? Every year we try and work through a theme which helps prepare us, lead us up to the events of Holy Week and Easter. And this year what we're going to do is we're going to focus on the seven words that Jesus speaks from the cross. There are seven sayings of Jesus which are recorded by the gospel writers as coming from Jesus' mouth on the cross. And we're going to cover those in the next 6 weeks. The seventh one we're going to be looking at on Good Friday, and then we're going to be taking something right from his mouth after the resurrection on Easter Sunday. The thing is that means through the whole of Lent, our focus is going to be on the cross. Now, this is a tough focus for us. The truth of the matter is that there's more of you here on Easter Sunday to celebrate the resurrection than there is here on Good Friday or at Gladys's on Good Friday to mark the death of Jesus. And partly that's just organizational, but partly I think that's because it's a tough thing to look at the cross. Because the cross faces us up to our own evil, our own shortcomings, the things that we struggle with in terms of our own moral compass, the things that we've done wrong. There's not just guilt to deal with, but there's also shame. And there's the fact that the world looks awful broken. And when we look at Jesus on the cross, there is no more poignant image of this one sinless, extraordinary, God-incarnate human being nailed to a piece of wood. For the expedience of the religious, of the political authorities and the hatred of the religious authorities. It's absolutely awful. And so what we're going to do is we're going to be at the cross week by week. But as many of you know, because you wear crosses around your necks or you've got them, you know, attached to your vehicles or whatever it may be, the cross is transformed from this image of ancient execution, which the Romans nicked off, who knows, particularly cruel and humiliating way to kill someone. It takes that image and it turns it into something redemptive. So that now when you see a cross, you think about Jesus. And so that cross is going to be the focus of what we look at, and particularly Jesus' last words before his death and then resurrection. So today we're in Luke 23, in verses 23 and 24. You can read it with me. Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they are doing. Now, this verse comes right after the point where the soldiers nail Jesus to the cross and they start to cast lots for his clothes. And he speaks to them, over them, Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. This is an extraordinarily well-known teaching of Jesus. Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. I don't know if you have been in a situation where some cruelty has been happening to you, or you see something unfolding, and these very words start to fall from your lips. Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. And as that forgiveness is given out, Jesus' mission, right at this point where he has shouldered up the sin of the world at Gethsemane, carried it to the cross, and is nailed to the cross, he speaks over the very people who perpetrated this deed, his forgiveness. Now in Luke 6:35, and of course in Matthew 5 in the Sermon on the Mount, but in Luke in the Sermon on the Plain, Jesus says these words, love your enemies. Love your enemies. One of the most distinctive things about Jesus' teaching, we looked at it last Remembrance Sunday. But love your enemies. These three words that define Jesus' approach to breaking the cycle of hatred and vengeance, of sin, of the descent into chaos and evil and brokenness that our world goes through. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Is a declaration right at the point when Jesus' mettle was tested, he was faithful to his own teaching. And one of the things that's extraordinary about Jesus is his utter integrity between life and action, what he says, what he does. So who's he forgiving? What does it actually mean? Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Well, obviously, he's speaking forgiveness over the soldiers. Traditionally, executioners would ask for the forgiveness of the person that they were about to execute. That practice went on right until capital punishment was finished in this country. And that forgiveness is spoken over those soldiers, recognizing that they had a job to do. Now, don't get me wrong, the cruelty and brutality of being a Roman soldier would have brought pleasure to some in ways that are unimaginably cruel, but they also had their orders to carry out. And if Jesus had left from the cross alive, their lives would be forfeit. It's one of the primary reasons that we know that Jesus was dead, because if Jesus wasn't dead, then the people who were carrying out the execution would have been killed themselves. So at that basic level, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're doing. It's just spoken over the people who are involved in this act of utter brutality. It's the soldiers. It's also, I guess, forgiveness for those deserting disciples. Now, all but John, the youngest of the disciples, have run. And for obvious reasons, their lives were under threat. Peter's already denied, as Jesus has prophesied, having said that he would stand beside Jesus until the end, and having bravely drawn his sword against the Roman cohort that came to arrest Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, Peter's now deserted because of the challenges. It's funny, isn't it? In the heat of the moment, often we're a lot braver than we are when temptation sneaks in and we've got longer to contemplate what's going to happen if we are true to our faith. So Jesus is forgiving them, his deserting friends. I think he's also speaking forgiveness over the religious authorities who are there, the ones who have pressed and pressed Pilate to have him executed. He's speaking forgiveness over them. But he is also speaking forgiveness over us. Now, whatever you think about the excesses of the life of Mel Gibson, when he came to make the film, The Passion of the Christ, which is a tough watch in its 15 cut, let alone the 18 cut, he made sure that when it came to the moment that Jesus' hands were being dramatically nailed to the cross, the hand and the hammer were his. It's his hands that you see. Because as he said in interviews afterwards, I put him there. And with responsibility for that film, he felt he could do no other than to put himself dramatically into that position where you see the moment that Jesus is crucified. And Jesus' forgiveness that he speaks at the cross is over those people who are gathered there, the Jewish authorities. It's just extraordinary, isn't it? That the one for whom they had been praying was now being executed at their behest. Extraordinary. But that forgiveness is also spoken over us. That forgiveness is also spoken over us. This is Jesus' universal declaration of forgiveness for those who would trust in him. And he is doing the priestly thing on behalf of the people of declaring over the people that they are forgiven. We'll come back to that. But now I want to take us back in time. For some of us, I realize this is taking us too far back in time because you weren't born yet. But I want to take you back to Remembrance Sunday, 1987, the 8th of November, 1987. All over the Western world, Remembrance Day parades were gathering, including in the quiet border town in Northern Ireland of Enniskillen. And as soon as I say that word, for those of us who are around to hear, we know what's coming next. As people gathered to remember those who gave their lives in two world wars, at 10:48 a.m., the peace was shattered when an IRA bomb went off, killing 11 immediately, and unbelievably, by the year 2000 or so, a 12th who was in a persistent coma until they died. Injuring many. And forever marking that community with this atrocity. For those of us who heard that news on the BBC News, I mean, it's just burned into our memory, and the name Enniskillen is forever associated with this, and it would be just another atrocity in the Troubles were it not for one remarkable thing. And that was the interview with this man, Gordon Wilson. Gordon Wilson was the local draper. He sold clothes in the high street in Enniskillen. And he was there at that act of remembrance. And as he lay in the rubble of the collapsed buildings, his daughter, Mary, was holding his hand tightly. She was 20 years old, just qualified as a nurse, had her whole life in front of her. And he asked her four times, "Are you all right?" And she said, "I'm fine, Dad. I'm fine." But in between saying that, she was screaming. And he said in that interview that he could not understand why she said she was fine, she was screaming. And then when he asked her a final time, she said, "Daddy, I love you so much." And that's the last thing she uttered. Let me read to you from the obituary that was written at Gordon Wilson's death in 1995 in The Independent. After the 1987 Poppy Day explosion in Enniskillen, two images flashed across the road, writes the journalist. The first was the fact that an IRA bomb had killed 11 Protestant civilians as they gathered on Remembrance Day. The second was Gordon Wilson's almost superhuman display of Christian charity and forgiveness. Wilson and his daughter, Mary, who was a nurse aged 20, were buried in the rubble by the explosion. He survived and she did not. His broadcast account of lying in the debris holding her hand was one of the most poignant and affecting moments of the quarter century of Irish Troubles. Wilson died yesterday in Enniskillen, County Fermanagh, at the age of 67, after being suddenly taken ill. He'll go down in Irish history as the man who, after his daughter's death, recounted that her last words were, "Daddy, I love you very much." And he summoned the strength of character to add, "She was a great wee lassie, she was a pet, and she's dead, but I bear no ill will. I bear no grudge." The savagery of the IRA bombers, the tragedy and futility of Mary Wilson's death, and Gordon Wilson's personal victory over bitterness meant that in Ireland, the Enniskillen attack will never be forgotten. In the aftermath, he received a tribute from the Queen and was voted Man of the Year by BBC's Today program ahead of Terry Waite and Mikhail Gorbachev. He said then, with characteristic modesty, "I'm not worthy of it. The others are very important people. I'm not in their class. I'm just an ordinary guy." Later, he wrote a book, Mary, and did what he could for the cause of peace. He attracted unionist criticism in 1993 when he accepted an Irish government invitation to become a member of the Irish Senate, where he made a number of heartfelt contributions. And some months later, more controversy followed when he asked to meet the IRA in the hope that a personal appeal might reach them following the Warrington bombing in which two young children died. But he reported sadly, "They listened, but they made no change in their position. Perhaps it was naive of me to imagine that because it was me, they would. I went in innocence to search for what my heart told me might be a way forward. I got nothing." By August 1994, however, the IRA campaign had ceased. And 2 months later, Gordon Wilson sat alongside Sinn Féin representatives in the Forum for Peace and Reconciliation in Dublin. His appeal for continuing peace brought a standing ovation. After Mary's death, Wilson said, "Don't ask me, please, for a purpose. I don't have a purpose, I don't have an answer, but I know there has to be a plan. It's part of a greater plan, and God is good." In fact, Enniskillen can now, with hindsight, be described as one of the turning points of the Troubles. The deaths of Mary Wilson and 10 other people had crucial repercussions for Republicans, for they put an end to Sinn Féin's hope of an expansion, especially into the Irish Republic. An IRA spokesman admitted that the outer reaches of Republican support were just totally devastated. And the incident helped initiate a rethink with IRA and Sinn Féin, and that in turn led to the debate which eventually produced the ceasefire, which from the obituary's point of view was the last year. Over the past year, Gordon Wilson may have had the comfort of reflecting that the tragedy of Enniskillen planted a seed which years afterwards helped his country move from war to peace. In the longer form interview that the BBC journalist did, he said, "I bear no ill will, neither does my wife." And that act of courage, in the face of utter barbarity, was all done because of Jesus. You see, behind every evil act, there lies a dark hand. One of the extraordinary things is that when things go wrong in people's lives, when they struggle, when things are difficult, oftentimes their first thought is, if there's a God, why does he allow this? When I talk with atheists, they'll say, well, how can there be a God of love in a world where there's such brutality? And friends, of course, they have a point. But the scriptures don't give a picture of a God who's made a world that is as is. It portrays a picture of a world that was as it should be, but fell, is broken. And behind every dark act, there lies a hand, a dark hand. And no matter how callous and cruel and calculating we as human agents are in our vengeances and our petty ambitions, we have no idea who we are cooperating with when we are cruel. No idea at all. For the malice and the wickedness and the brokenness that is in the enemy is beyond description. It is as evil as Jesus is good. And thank God, he has been overcome at the cross. But that needs to be worked out day by day in our lives. And of course at the cross. And one of the reasons that we find it difficult to look at the cross is because Satan wanted Jesus dead. Wanted rid of God incarnate. Wanted rid of his influence in the world. And the cross appears to be the triumph of that. But in God's gracious wisdom, of course, Jesus' murder becomes the means for our rescue. Do you hear me? Jesus' murder becomes the means by which we are rescued. Jesus knew this was coming. He knew this was coming. He warns his friends. He says, I'll be taken from you. Soon I won't be with you, but don't worry, for I'll never leave you or forsake you. I'm sending the Comforter to be with you. He says, the Son of Man is going to die as a ransom for many, give his life as a ransom for many. All through the Gospels, there's these echoes of perhaps what Isaiah was seeing when he talked about a suffering servant who would come in Isaiah 40 and in Isaiah 53. Indeed, in Isaiah 61, Jesus draws his mission from the Spirit of the Sovereign Lord is upon me because he's anointed me to preach good news to the poor, freedom to captives, sight to the blind. So Jesus' mission is about rescuing a broken humanity. It is the opposite of what the enemy intends. And this world, friends, is in conflict. It's in conflict. There's a tug of war. The final battle is yet to happen, but the war will be won. For the cross is the crucial battle. New Testament scholar George Eldon Ladd used to describe it like this. Nobody realistically imagined that once a beachhead had been established in Normandy in 1944, in June of 1944, that the Germans would win the Second World War. But 90% of the casualties for the Western powers happened after that date, after June the 6th, 1944. The greatest carnage was going to happen, but the decisive victory had already been won. And so it is with us. The cross is the crucial battle, and we are involved in the tug of war that happens after it. Satan is a defeated enemy, but because he can work in our free will and through the power structures of this world, we still come up against that blackness all the time. And he hides and hides and hides and influences. So what does Jesus do at the cross? Jesus could have taken any Jewish festival, but the Jewish festival he takes is the Passover. It might help us to just briefly recap what the Passover was. The Passover was the last of the 10 plagues when Moses is sent to Pharaoh to say, "Let my people go." And the God of the enslaved Jews goes head to head with the living God who was the Pharaoh. And Pharaoh appears to relent on a few occasions, but will not release the slaves. And Moses finally steps into there with the worst of all the plagues. And this last plague will mirror the butchery that Pharaoh's father had visited on the children of the Jews. Remember, Moses is the last surviving boy of that generation. All the others were drowned, killed. And ironically, Moses is rescued from death by Pharaoh's own daughter. And then heads off into the wilderness after discovering his identity, fighting and killing an Egyptian guard. And coming back from exile, he declares to the Pharaoh that he is to let the people go. And the angel of death goes over all of Egypt. And those households that hear Moses' words and obey, their firstborn are spared. What do? Kill a one-year-old lamb or a goat. Take the blood, apply it to the doorposts. Use that lamb for a celebratory meal. Eat the meal with unleavened bread so it can be packed away. Make sure you've got your cloak and your sandals and your stuff because you are about to leave slavery. But it's the blood on the doorposts that causes death to pass over. And here's Jesus. Here's Jesus having reshaped the Passover meal where instead of having lamb, we have bread and wine, and Jesus is the lamb. The Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, as his cousin John declares over him at his baptism. Jesus then steps into that place, and on the doorposts of that wooden cross, his blood is applied so that death might pass over each one of us. That's the Passover. And in doing so, Jesus, the Passover Lamb, becomes the high priest of all the people and declares over all the people, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. They have no idea the evil forces with which they are conspiring with their rebellion." And Jesus does that because he can. And he does that over the soldiers as they gamble for his clothes. Jesus, knowing that that is a fulfillment of the prophecy as David wrote the 22nd Psalm, that they will cast lots for your clothes. Your hands and feet will be pierced. And the first verse of that Psalm, my God, why have you forsaken me? We will look at that in some weeks in the future. It's extraordinary. You read Psalm 22. It's like David could see the crucifixion. It's absolutely extraordinary. 1,000 years before it happened. Now, we live in a society where law and order is well established. And though sometimes things happen that cause us concern, by and large, our justice system works well. And so when we talk about forgiveness, we're often talking about interpersonal forgiveness. But hear me. The one who forgives, the one who can forgive, is also the one who judges. Do you hear me? The reason that Jesus can forgive is because God has given him that task of judging. Jesus, the forgiver, is also Jesus, the judge. Why am I telling you that? Well, first of all, it's important you know that. For the one who forgives your sin is the one who knows what you've done, knows how broken you are, knows what I do, knows my petty rebellions and stupidity and wickedness. He knows. He's the one who forgives. The one who knows me best loves me most. And that is extraordinary because none of my flaws is he blind to. For a wee lighter moment, sometimes I come across people who say, well, I've stopped going to that church because, I don't know, the preacher was lousy or they did something, you know, one of the people in the church did something. And sometimes these stories are quite sad, but they'll say these things, you know. And if I think they're being a bit sensitive, I'll say to them, warning. Do you think when Jesus went to the synagogue, which he did every Saturday, by the way, do you think he could find some theological problems with what the rabbi said? Do you think he might have some issues with how the rabbi was interpreting this bit of Deuteronomy or that bit of Isaiah or this psalm or that passage in Genesis? Do you think he could see the folks who were off in Adwam thinking about other things? Do you think he could see the relational tensions within the synagogue? Do you think he could sit there with a papyrus and scribble down everything that was wrong with that synagogue? And yet somehow Jesus was able to get past himself and worship God. He was able to do that. You see, some of us imagine that it's our job to find everything that's at fault with everybody else. Gordon Wilson was extraordinary. He saw that there were problems on both sides, on the Unionist side and the Republican side of the debate in Northern Ireland, and in the South too. And he did everything that he could to alleviate that. That's why he took up the role as a senator. He got virulent letters from some unionists about the fact that he was even prepared to talk to these people. But could you imagine how uncomfortable those IRA Sinn Féin people were in the presence of a man who had declared forgiveness over them? Why? Because he had something against them. They killed his daughter and blew the heart out of his town. And so in the same way, Jesus has that ability to judge us, but he chooses to love us. As Jesus' own kid brother would write in his book, James wrote, because mercy triumphs over judgment. It's not that mercy is more important than judgment. It's that in the final summation of things, if there's any reason at all that God can find to forgive us, not ignore it, forgive us, he will. And if there's a need for justice, then the permanent reference point for every atrocity, wrongdoing, betrayal, and hatred in this world, every addiction and relational breakdown, every petty-minded bit of horrific nastiness finds its end at the cross. It's judged there. And as it's judged there, the one who bears that weight proclaims forgiveness over us. Friends, this is no easy transaction. We should never take it for granted. It should bring us to our knees and fill our eyes with tears and our minds with wonder that the Son of God laid down his life for us. The one who judges is the one who forgives. And so the Father, Son, and Spirit, our God, three in one, conspire to find a way that the world can be remade we can be forgiven, and our free will to rebel can be laid down as we freely choose to love Him. Do you see that transaction? The cross is waiting for our response. It has been waiting for our response right from the moment that we're born. And at the point we respond to the cross, the forgiveness for our sin and the judgment for our sin has already been carried out. We just need to trust that it's true. The moment that we put our weight on that, the burden is lifted from us. And those words which Jesus spoke apply to us. Now, it might be you're sitting there and saying, well, I haven't really done anything wrong. And friend, if that's you, then that's a failure of memory. Or you haven't, as Paul said, considered yourself with sober judgment. And if it's going to take some time for the blood alcohol level to come down, at that point, we so often catch ourselves in self-pity, but that warps us. And we might consider we're more sinned against than sinning, and that may well be true. But Jesus, who knew no sin, has forgiven me. And at that point, I am duty-bound to give up my right for vengeance. No matter how painful, no matter how difficult that process of forgiveness is, and friends, that can take years. Let me introduce you to someone else. This is Joan Wilson. And after his death, Gordon Wilson's wife, Joan, said that he felt that his earthly mission was complete. Now you think about this lady's life. She'd buried a murdered daughter. The year before Gordon's death in 1994, she buried her son Peter, who was killed in a car accident. The year after, Gordon, at the age of 67 or so, took a massive heart attack and died himself. And without a shred of bitterness, she gave thanks to God. Interviewed in 2017, now in her well into her 80s, by the Belfast Telegraph, she said this: every day I think of what happened to Mary, but I know that we will meet again. And the journalist wrote of the strength that she derived from her faith in Jesus Christ. And she said this: I read a passage from the Bible every day, and I know that I have been able to come through everything because of the strength I have been given by God. He has been and still is with me every step of the way. And very soon, she will go to be with them. But she will do it. In pain? Yeah. With bitterness? No. A remarkable lady. So friends, as we gather around the communion table, we gather around the table for the rescued and the forgiven. A table for the rescued and forgiven. And friends, last words are really important. Really, really important. And as Jesus speaks these, the first of these seven words, over the people who are gathered there at the foot of the cross, but over us. And He calls us to follow Him in the way of forgiveness. The bitterness would not take root in our heart. And that we might get the grace from that same Jesus by His Spirit to be able to say on an interview in the aftermath of our tragedy, I bear no ill will. I carry no grudge. God is good. May we pray.